The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Heather Stewart. This week...
What I, members of the Cabinet and the whole government are doing is working to ensure that we leave the European Union with a deal. Yeah. And that is the way to avoid no deal.
As Theresa May returned to Parliament with her Plan B, which looked to all intents and purposes much like her Plan A, the Brexit crystal ball remains obstinately cloudy. One thing everyone can agree on is that the UK is edging perilously close to crashing out of Europe without a deal, which for some isn't such a bad thing. We take a look at the pros and cons. Also this week, Parliament, proxy voting and pregnant MPs. We talk to the Lib Dem Joe Swinson about dragging the House of Commons into the 21st century. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first... It felt like Groundhog Day, said Jeremy Corbyn, as Theresa May announced her Brexit Plan B on Monday. Despite suffering the biggest parliamentary defeat in history, nothing had changed. May said she was listening, but rejected a second referendum or extending Article 50. She also refused to take the possibility of a no-deal Brexit off the table, despite anxious pleas from business and MPs. And there seems to be a sense of growing support for a no-deal Brexit away from Parliament. In an ICM poll last week, the most popular option for what happens next was no deal, backed by 28% of voters. I'm joined on the phone now by The Guardian's John Harris, who's been travelling the country and taking its Brexit temperature. John, I think apart from anything else, you've been to see Tim Martin, the boss of Wetherspoons, banging the drum for no deal.
Yeah, Tim Martin is touring the country. I don't know whether he's still doing it, but he was doing it for quite a time, you know, just before Christmas and into a lot of January, going to three of his pubs every day and making a speech about why no deal was by far the best idea. And I went to see him in Portsmouth at 10:30 on a Friday morning. And I thought in my innocence, no one would be there. And I was wrong. The pub was packed with men, mostly quite a lot of them on the pints already before 11 o'clock. And the local Lib Dems came to sort of ambush and disrupt it somewhat, and it all got very, very testy. You know, teetered on the brink of violence on occasion. It was quite a thing to see. I've never seen people go hammer and tongs about trade tariffs before they've even had lunch.
10 o'clock in the morning.
It was a bit much, but it was sort of fascinating to see.
And what's the argument? What's the lure of it? Because if you sit in Westminster or Whitehall, you know, there's a kind of sharp intake of breath at the idea of no deal. You know, we can't possibly be ready. We haven't got time. It'll be so disruptive. What's the appeal of it?
I mean, Tim Martin claims there are good economic reasons for it, but what he says doesn't really stand up under any inspection. I mean, if you talk to him about it, he says tariffs on imports are a matter of discretion and the government could just waive them. But when he's asked about exports, he just sort of dries up. He doesn't have anything very convincing to say about the island of Ireland and a hard border and all of that. What's more fascinating is not him, really. It's the people who profess to support no deal who certainly gathered there. And if you believe opinion polls, it's about 25% of the population, if asked, say a no deal is their favoured outcome. And it's a clean break, you know. It's just, I've had enough of this. Let's just stop it now and leave.
Yeah. Makes a kind of intuitive sense, doesn't it?
You just walk away. It kind of chimes, therefore, with some people's interpretation of the referendum result. Do you want to leave the European Union? Right, well, let's leave with a capital L. And you won't be surprised to hear me say that swirling around all that are all sorts of, you know, cultural and national things about Britain standing alone and the perfidious Europeans and little entrails of empire. And, you know, if I'm going out talking to people now, I can usually be fairly certain that inside about 90 minutes someone will mention Winston Churchill and indicate they know nothing
really in Parliament as well, to be honest.
I mean, I don't know that much about Winston Churchill, but I do know that he would have been pretty horrified at the shriller aspects elements of the pro-Brexit lot. But that's what comes up, you know. It's an expression of some version of identity politics to some extent. It's quite male. There's another fascinating thing. If you look at a recent YouGov poll, 28% of men are in favour of no deal, and among women the figure is 16%. That's really interesting.
What's that about, do you think?
It's like Trump politics. It's sort of enemies and confrontation and all or nothing and clean breaks and all of that. They're quite testosterone-y sentiments, I suppose.
Yeah, and you think of the sort of Boris Johnson and David Davis and Dominic Raab, the sort of political fans of this kind of approach, who take a sort of bullish approach, and it's almost as though, you know, if only we were tougher about it, you know, if we were a tougher stance.
I definitely think that that's another reflection of it. Although no one brings their names up when you're out in the field, so to speak. Same as in the referendum, you know. I think the extent to which those people are leading any of this is often overstated. People, unprompted, don't mention David Davis, and Boris comes up a bit, but only usually in a sort of mocking way. I don't think anyone out there sets huge store by what he has to say. Jacob Rees-Mogg never comes up. Even Farage, people mention a lot less than some people might think. It comes from a deeper place, to my mind. It comes from stuff about nation and identity and belonging and maleness and all of that. And some of it's pretty horrible to be around. I felt quite uncomfortable in that pub.
And Theresa May said this week, when she was talking about her Brexit plans, you know, I think if we had enough the referendum, it would threaten social cohesion, you know, because it would undermine people's faith in democracy. Does that feel right from conversations that you
some,
have?
I think there's some truth. I mean, she would say that, wouldn't she? I think there's some truth in that. I think it's, but at the same time, I think it's very easy to see people like those awful fellas in yellow jackets who swarmed around Parliament a couple of weeks back and think that they speak for a large swathe of the population, and I don't think they do. I don't think we're a country still. I mean, this sort of goes back into the myths of George Orwell and stuff, but I don't think we're a country in which people express their dissent by going out and burning cars and breaking things. There was a piece in the Daily Telegraph, a pretty nonsensical piece, I thought, a couple of weeks ago, about how Middle England would stop paying its TV licence and deliberately park its cars on double yellow lines in the event of a second referendum.
Wow.
I think the danger of a second referendum, and I personally, if push comes to shove, I think on balance, with heavy reservations, I might still think it's the only way out of the mess. It sort of varies day to day for me, that. But I think the biggest danger would be that the way that it made people feel about their voice and whether it was heard wouldn't manifest itself in civil disorder and all that. It would be like a low, grudging disconnection, which would go on for years. I think that is a problem. We're British, you know, what we tend to do, or English is more relevant in this case. You know, when we're brassed off, we don't tend to make a big song and dance about it. We just tend to sit there and grumble.
Grumble, yeah.
And I think that would, you know, and grumbling has political relevance and can make things very difficult. And I think that would be a danger of it. But equally, there are also, you know, there are dangers with other things, you know, with this Norway Plus, this supposed option. I think that could easily be presented to the public as Brexit in name only, and therefore the referendum hadn't been listened to.
Theresa May calls it a politician's Brexit, which I think is quite a clever.
Yeah, I can see that, totally. So, you know, and equally, Brexit itself, whether Theresa May's deal or no deal, has so many dangers within it, it's impossible really to say how the public would react to it. You know, there are no safe spaces here. I think this is why political journalists like you and me, in our quieter moments, gather in the corner of pubs and say, isn't this awful? You know, I think this is going to go on for years and years and years, and it's not going to be very nice, whatever happens.
I'm glad we talked to you, John. You've cheered me right up.
Oh, we'll be fine. Everyone's really happy out there. There's bunting hanging everywhere, and we're all drinking English sparkling wine, as served by Tim Martin.
Brexit juice, they call it, the
Brexit
levers.
Brexit juice, indeed.
John Harris, thanks very much. Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by my expert panel, The Guardian's Dan Sabber, The Observer's Michael Savage and Katie Balls from The Spectator. Dan, how have we reached this point where a no deal looks like a realistic possibility? Are the government to blame for keeping it on the table?
Well, everyone collectively is to blame. The kind of balance, you know, the balance of forces, the inability to agree a deal has meant that, you know, one sense, no deal is looming large. You know, where can we begin with this failure? You know, Theresa May's not been able to carry her own side or any side or anybody other than a sort of close group of people with her. She's only got 200 odd votes behind her plan when she tested it out last time, and not any sense that she's got, you know, maybe a few more, and we'll get onto that, but, you know, not yet a decisive amount more. So yeah, guess what? No deal looms, and the reaction, it's the reaction from industry that's really been interesting in the last few days, but businesses are starting to get really worried and starting to get more and more vocal. You know, Airbus, for example, a huge civil aircraft maker, threatening hastily to move the sort of, you know, manufacturer of wings from Broughton in Bristol, for example. So that has become the noisy argument, and as a result, people are starting to aim off that.
And Michael, it gets breezily said, doesn't it, that there won't be a no deal because there's a majority in Parliament against it. And we'll talk a bit more in detail about amendments, specific amendments later, but it's not completely obvious, is it, how Parliament goes about stopping a no deal?
Not at all. I mean, you know, there's all sorts of parliamentary wheezes going on, but the law is dictated by Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, which says we leave at the end of March. That is the law. That is the default situation. And you get experts saying, for example, Sir Ivan Rogers, our former EU ambassador, he thinks no deal is being underpriced still. And so that's the situation we find ourselves at, you know, really, really short time, and still is completely unresolved. You know, to have no deal, you need a deal, to state the obvious.
Which, as Theresa May keeps saying, hey, Katie, how many Conservative MPs do you think actually want no deal, would actually sort of relish this idea?
I think the ones who would like it above anything else, you probably have, I would say, a hardcore group at 20 who would prefer it to the point that they wouldn't even consider voting for Theresa May's deal, even if she got a concession on the backstop, because they are purists. I think there is a higher group who think that it has been hyped up as a bad thing. It is Project Fear, a lot of the warnings, that actually it is something that dealable, no deal, and you could do things to make it work. That group is larger, but they would ultimately prefer a deal. But I definitely think there is a sizable contingent of the Conservative Party who think if you are going to perhaps have these indicative votes, no deal would sit probably at number two for them after Theresa May's deal. So there is this idea that you could do things to manage it. I think that there are still some in that group, however, including cabinet ministers, who think with the current numbers in Parliament, that gets a lot harder to do. And we saw that with a few of the attempts in recent weeks to try and restrain what the government could do in the event of a no deal on, you know, finances, on what rules they could bring in. So this idea of perhaps having a rush of, you know, low tax and business friendly moves in terms of an emergency budget
to sort of mitigate a no deal.
To mitigate it, to say, you know, come here, we're gonna slash this so we keep investment coming in. I think there is a realization that it wouldn't take too many MPs, and there probably are enough in the Tory party alone to say, I'm not going along with this. People like Sarah Williston, perhaps, who, you know, the Remain contingent, who I think would make it very hard for the government to do what they think would make it doable.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some Brexiters, aren't there, who worry that if you had a softer Brexit of the kind that might emerge if you looked across party and you found a consensus, the public out there in the world, certainly the people that John Harris was talking to in his Wetherspoons, would say this isn't Brexit and be furious about it.
Yeah, there's definitely a view that there is a Brexit in name only on the horizon. I mean, some people think that is Theresa May's deal, but I think you can take it beyond that. And there is a genuine concern that if Theresa May were to lurch to Labour policy by agreeing to a permanent customs union, which is probably one of the only ways I think you could see maybe how you would get a majority in the Commons for a Brexit deal, that would be toxic to the Tory base. Tory activists would struggle, I think, to get out on the doors the next time and say, didn't our party do a great job? Vote for us
again. Doing that deal with Jeremy Corbyn.
Exactly, and stopping free trade. Because the thing that's worth noting is when it comes to Conservative Euroscepticism, free trade is a key plank. They say that they see the EU as protectionist. So if you go for a full customs union, you are getting rid of one of the main motivations that most Leave MPs.
And just get could, out, slash tariffs, strike it, new trade deals.
And you could say that the bulk of the Leave vote wasn't to do with free trade. Some people say, oh, it's more immigration. But if you look specifically at the Conservative MPs, I would say the majority of those who campaigned for Leave wanted to do it for things like free trade.
There's an interesting point here, I think, about the wider public and no deal and how popular the idea is. I sometimes hear people saying, well, you know, they think that, you know, if there's a no deal, we'll just carry on as we are. There's actually no real evidence for that in the polling. You ask, you know, what happens if there's a no deal? Only about 4% think we go back to a sort of status quo. So the problem isn't that. It's
so
much more...
they know
more,
there would be disruption.
Yeah. People know
it might be a price worth paying.
People know it's a big deal. The question is, they just don't believe some of the, you know, sort of cataclysmic consequences that they get told, because they're told largely by Remainers and, quote unquote, the establishment that wanted to stay in the first place.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem with some of the conversations about this, Dan, isn't it? Is that there's a sense of a sort of establishment stitch-up, or of a, you know, certainly the second referendum campaign gets talked about in these kinds of terms. You know, these people who lied to us before are lying to us again?
Well, as a young journalist, I used to work as a computer journalist once.
You still are a young journalist, Dan.
Thank you. I used to work as a computer journalist once upon long ago and wrote about the Millennium Computer Bug. And I spent we all spent collectively 2-3 years of our life writing about what a terrible thing the Millennium Computer Bug would be. And, you know, I think a tidal gauge in Portsmouth failed and absolutely nothing happened. And that analogy is trotted out, actually, in the context of a no-deal Brexit. So in one sense, I've got sympathy with that argument that actually there, this is Project Fear Mark 2 and that, that no-deal is hyped up. But, and I think this is a huge but, you know, no deal is just, you know, in the, within the House of Commons, there is no majority for no deal. In fact, the people vehemently against it, and some of the most people most vehemently against it, are in senior positions of the Conservative Party. You know, your Philip Hammonds, your Amber Rudds, your David Gawkes, your Greg Clarks, you know, and there's a big constituency of Conservative opinion that goes with that. And I think, you know, if a no deal was a realistic possibility, there will be a serious attempt by Parliament to kind of wrest control. And we're obviously clearly seeing that with the Cooper Amendment and also the much simpler Jack Dromey, Caroline Spelman Amendment, which invites MPs to make a declaration against no deal. And I think in that point, you would see something that looked a bit like a constitutional crisis, where if the executive, because obviously the default assumption, as we all know, is that we would leave on WTO terms on a no deal basis. But I think we would have a potential for a constitutional crisis here, because you're an executive drifting towards no deal. You'd have Parliament emphatically against it, but struggling with the tools to try and find a way of legislating to prevent that.
Michael, did Jeremy Corbyn do the right thing refusing Theresa May's invitation to go and have a chat about Brexit? She was throwing it back in his face at Prime Minister's questions this week, wasn't she? You know, you won't even talk to me, you won't even come and talk to me about it. Did he do the right thing saying she had to take no deal off the table first?
Well, it's certainly a debate within the Labour Party, indeed a split within the Labour Party, whether or not he did the right thing. I think basically the two camps are broadly the Corbyn and wider than Corbyn camp, actually, that say, well, this is a trick, basically. We're being conned into sort of going along with some ploy from Downing Street. And then the other argument, which is actually, you know, the country just wants everyone to grow up, wake up and come up with something along cross-party lines. I think what we certainly know now from when the cross-party talk was starting a week or so ago is that actually Theresa May is going to revert to trying to win over Tories and the DUP to get her deal over the line. In other words, Plan B looks a lot like Plan A, because essentially it is Plan A.
That's right, Katie, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, personally, I think it was bad politics on Jeremy Corbyn's part on this, just because had he just gone in, I mean, Theresa May clearly, in all these cross-party talks, as Michael has just pointed out, wasn't in listening mode in the purest sense, given that she's basically decided to stick with
certainly
her
not in hearing mode
plan. So had he just gone in and said to her something like, if you commit to a permanent customs union, which is Labour's policy, then we can start talking, that would put Theresa May in an incredibly difficult position. She is already under pressure from half her cabinet to do that. The remain-leaning ones that Dan mentioned, Philip Hammond, Amber Rudd. Then you could start to say that Theresa May was refusing the way that you could actually get a deal through the Commons. So does she want to go for no deal? And you would also manage to get rid of what we've had, these Tory attack lines saying he'll speak to Hamas, he won't speak to the Prime Minister of the country. So I think ultimately, just in terms of whether or not it was is the right thing in terms of, you know, Labour unity, I just think that it was a bit of an own goal, because at PMQs, he did manage to put this week, he did put Theresa May under a bit of pressure on her Brexit policy. But had he been actually able to say, I did speak to you and you're not listening, from my first-hand experience, I think that would have been even more effective.
Dan, they're neither of them politicians who've spent much of their lives doing deals or talking to the opposition, are they? Or trying to win over voters who've previously supported another party, both Jeremy Corbyn and Theresa May?
I think they're both very tribal. Yes, I think tribal is a good way of putting it. They're both very far apart. Although, you know, as Katie said, you know, Jeremy Corbyn has talked endlessly about the importance of dialogue and has met all sorts of organisations in the past. But I think on this occasion, I've got some sympathy for Corbyn's position, because I just don't think that the PM was listening. You know, was listening at all. Was going to listen. I think he would have. You know, I think he would have achieved absolutely nothing. Now, the question is, you can obviously do what Nicola Sturgeon did, and you can, you know, go in number 10 and come outside and make a statement. The optics of Jeremy Corbyn making a statement in Downing Street, how would that, and what would the Daily Mail front page do with that picture? I don't know. I just think, like, I think that's actually, you know, I wonder whether that would play well for Labour's base or could be used as a way of kind of sort of scaring, you know, scaring Conservative voters at a crucial time.
And also one of, I suppose, one of his kind of great selling points is that he's a different kind of politician. He's you know, he's sort of anti-politics. He doesn't do things in the same way that others do.
Well, I think probably in the end, there was pretty clear politics on both sides here.
Sure.
Theresa May laying out a whole load of red lines before she would talk. Corbyn asking May to take no deal off the table, something we've just discussed she actually can't do, even if she wanted to. So I think in the end, it's fairly inevitable this would happen, and on we go. No solution, the public thinking, when is this going to get sorted out?
Not just the public. Thank you all. And we'll be paying another visit to the sunny uplands of Brexit later in the show. Now, the English Parliament has been around since the 13th century, but sometimes it feels as though some of its rules and traditions haven't changed very much since. Despite it being 100 years since the first female Member of Parliament took her seat at Westminster, MPs still weren't allowed to vote by proxy if they were on maternity or paternity leave. But when Labour MP Tulip Sadiq opted to delay the birth of her son by 2 days in order to vote against the EU withdrawal agreement earlier this month and was pushed into Parliament to vote in a wheelchair, there was an outcry. It was finally announced this week by Andrea Leadsom, the leader of the House of Commons, that proxy voting will be introduced on a one-year pilot. Earlier, I spoke to one of those behind the move, the Lib Dems' Jo Swinson.
Jo, you and colleagues had a win this week.
Absolutely. We managed to force the government into action on proxy voting, which has been long overdue, nearly a year since the House of Commons first decided to do it. And we'd been waiting on the government to bring forward the motion, because only they can put that motion down for the House to actually look at it. And they have said we will be having that motion on Monday. So this is a really good step forward. And this is really hot on the heels of last week when we all saw Tulip Sadiq, the Labour MP, delaying her caesarean section in order that she was not going to have her constituents disenfranchised by her not being able to vote. And so she delayed her C-section so that she could vote. But, you know, in the 21st century, we should not be putting anyone in that position. And we need a much better system for pregnant women who are in the later stages of pregnancy and you know, new mums and dads who happen to be MPs. So this is a good step forward. We obviously still need to achieve it. You know, the government's bringing it forward. We'll see if it gets blocked on Monday. But it's pretty clear now that this is going to be happening pretty soon.
And tell us how the new system will work. What will it allow new mums to do?
So what it will mean is that if you're pregnant and childbirth is imminent, perhaps your constituency is far away and you're not going to be able to travel, or you have just had a baby, or, you know, whether you're a man or a woman, or just adopted a child, you will be able to apply for another MP to vote in your place. So you will name who that will be. You obviously agree it with them. It may be a close by MP from your own party. I think it would often be that who you trust. That will be printed on the order paper, and it means that whenever there is a vote called in the House of Commons, then they will go through and they will cast their vote, but they will also cast your vote. Mm-hmm. Just like if at an election you can't make it to the polling station for any reason and you vote by proxy. And so it will mean that your vote's recorded. And at the moment that can't happen. If you're not physically in Parliament, your vote cannot be recorded. Mm-hmm. There's different mechanisms like the pairing mechanism, which is pretty discredited after what happened to me last summer when I was at home with my two-week-old baby and I was supposed to be paired. That is, I wasn't voting, but neither was a government minister as well, so we evened each other out, except he went and voted. And so this was pretty appalling, and that's one of the reasons that Tulip Sadiq had quoted last week as to why she didn't feel comfortable relying on pairing for that important vote. So, but even with pairing, you wouldn't have your vote actually recorded with your name against it in Hansard. And so this is a much better system. And I think it's going to be a pilot that's introduced, but I think it will be really successful.
It was quite nice to see a sort of cross-party effort to make this happen, wasn't it? So the leader of the Commons, Andrea Leadsom, Conservative, of course, has pressed quite hard for this too, hasn't she?
Well, she has. And, you know, nobody really doubts her commitment to this issue. And then, of course, from the Labour side, Harriet Harman, the mother of the house, as she's called, because she's the longest-serving female MP, she has very much spearheaded this initiative. And there's a variety of MPs in different parties, including some of us who have had babies and been pregnant during this. So Kat Smith, the Labour MP, and myself were both there in the debate yesterday, have both had babies last summer. But equally so was Emma Reynolds, who is pregnant, Luciana Berger, who's pregnant. She wasn't able to make it because she had a maternity appointment. And on the government side, Chloe Smith was sitting there pregnant and was referred to her baby kicking away at one point. So in acclamation and agreement, no doubt. So there has been. And what was the other thing I thought was really good in the debate yesterday was the number of men standing up and welcoming this and talking movingly about the challenges of being an MP as a dad and spending so much time away from your family, for those who've got constituencies who are far flung and their families are perhaps in their constituency, and that feeling of guilt as well. So, you know, we all feel that as parents, and it was a really good cross-party atmosphere and quite novel at the moment in Parliament. It was rather unlike most other debates in this place recently.
And how far away are we from this place being a sort of family-friendly, a good place for parents to work?
Well, there's still a lot of change that needs to take place to the culture, to even some more change to the sitting hours and the procedures. There's been a lot of progress. I mean, I arrived here in 2005, and if I think back to then, it is a lot better. You know, we have the parliamentary nursery. They're now looking at having a parliamentary creche, which would be able to be used on a short-term basis if people, you know, are have children visiting in the school holidays, for example, rather than having it as standard childcare, or even for things like people coming to give evidence to a select committee who might just need a couple of hours of childcare in order to do it, because that's another thing. If you look at select committee witnesses in Parliament, you know, predominantly male, you know, older white middle-class men. So opening up Parliament in all those different ways still needs to happen. But there is progress, and you know, the Speaker at the moment, he is very modernising. So we have seen a lot of change, and it's important that we keep pressing for more. There's parts of being an MP that nobody could describe as family friendly. You know, there's parts of the job that require you to work in different parts of the country, and the responsibility is a 24/7 one. And so, like many other jobs, you know, is one that is very difficult to describe as family friendly. If someone's, you know, serving in the armed forces or working on an oil rig, or for people who are, you know, having to work two jobs to make ends meet, you know, none of that's family friendly, and there's bits of being an MP that's not family friendly. But I strongly believe that we need to have parents in Parliament, and we should just do the things that we can do to make it a bit friendlier and a little bit easier. And we are making progress with that, but changing the House of Commons is a slow and laborious process, and you know, in that way it's rather like childbirth itself.
Jo Swinson there. Katie, this is long overdue, isn't it?
I think it is overdue. I think if you look at Parliament and you compare it to any other workplace, it does seem slightly odd that we have the current system we do. And obviously it was brought to a head when Jo Swinson was supposed to be paired with Brandon Lewis back with the Brexit vote before Christmas. Now, Lib Dems understandably made a big point about this, saying the Tories can't be trusted and the Conservative Party got a lot of bad press. But it's not the first time a pairing arrangement hasn't worked. I think historically all the parties, when it gets those really crunch votes, and you can
a tight vote in a hung parliament,
something, yeah, tight vote, hung parliament, a vote that could bring down your government, you can see why it's not, you know, it's party wide. So that does mean that it's the system, I think, that's the problem.
A woman should not may have to be wheelchaired into work in order to do her job in 2019. It is the optics of this are terrible, and that's what happened to Tulip. That's what Tulip Sadiq felt she had to do, you know, in the Brexit vote on Tuesday night. And one can argue about whether there was an element of grandstanding or not. I don't, you know, forget that. It is just plain wrong. In any other workplace, it would be wrong.
OK, thanks all. We'll be back after this.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Now, with just 64 days and counting till we leave the European Union, and with May shooting down every option that doesn't resemble her own, where does that leave us? Well, MPs from across all parties are now trying to take more control of the Brexit process by tabling amendments, which try to avoid no deal, call for a second referendum, or even convene a citizens' assembly. MPs will vote on some of these amendments next Tuesday, and after that, who knows? Well, Dan, Michael and Katie, who are still with me, may hopefully be able to shed some light. But first, what's the view on all this from the EU? On the phone now, we have The Guardian's Brussels correspondent Jennifer Rankin. So, Jennifer, Theresa May stood up in Parliament this week and set out her next steps. How did it look from Brussels?
But I think people have been sitting in Brussels really quite aghast at the whole process, with more than a little weariness of Brexit. And after Theresa May made her speech to the House of Commons on Monday, I spoke to one EU official who just said, well, this is Groundhog Day, nothing has changed, and that there's really nothing new here. So as far as the EU is concerned, they're still waiting on the UK to reach a decision on a way forward for Brexit, and they don't see anything to negotiate in Brussels. And Ollie Robbins and the other civil servants have been told there's really no point in having negotiations when over the backstop, the sort of border insurance plan for Ireland, when we're not going to agree to change that. So we're very much as we were for much of last year on Brexit.
And on Article 50, if she came back and said, please give us some more time, what would the response to that likely to be?
I think there's been a very interesting change on the EU side on the question of extension. Because at the end of last year, when I was asking people about what might happen, the response was universally that it would be impossible to extend Article 50 beyond the European elections, which fall in late May. So they really felt that was the ultimate deadline. But there's been a real softening of the tone on this. I think that's best exemplified by Guy Verhofstadt, the Brexit coordinator for the European Parliament. Even last week, he was saying it would be unthinkable to extend Article 50 beyond the elections. And now this week, less than a week later, he's saying, well, we need to be firm and flexible about this. So I think there's a lot more openness to considering an extension. Although what you do hear again and again is that it has to be an extension for a reason, not simply an extension to prolong the agony of this whole process. But I think the EU will be very reluctant actually to sort of force the UK out the door, even if there is still some political uncertainty over what the House of Commons, what Parliament really wants from Brexit.
Right. And how much worry is there about a no deal as a possibility?
There's definitely worry about no deal. I mean, every other day we're hearing more news about the EU's no deal planning. Yesterday they adopted a new law on preparing the fishing industry for no deal, and there are little bits and pieces of legislation trickling through every day. So yeah, these preparations are definitely stepping up. It is seen as something they have to plan for, but nonetheless, increasingly there's also a suspicion or a feeling that a request from the UK to prolong Article 50 is now only a matter of time. And although they hear that the Prime Minister doesn't want to do this, nonetheless, they think even just to get her withdrawal agreement through Parliament in the form of the legislation and all the other related Brexit bills, they think the UK Parliament simply doesn't have the time to do that anymore. So it's an extension of Article 50 is seen as increasingly likely.
Jennifer Rankin, thanks very much. So let's take a quick look at some of these amendments. So, Michael, Labour's tabled its own amendment, hasn't it? Which is very carefully sort of, it's a result of a compromise, isn't it? And negotiations among a sort of rather divided shadow cabinet, I think it's fair to say. It puts their own deal on the table, doesn't it? But also the option of a referendum.
Yeah, and in the end, the problem, as we all know, with Labour's position is they're asking for something which is ill-defined and probably contradictory, which is a close relationship with the single market, but of course that leaves open a question about free movement rules, which obviously was a huge element in the referendum the first time round. And so there's lots of conservatives who would simply ask, what do you mean by that? And so there's a total lack of clarity about what that sort of deal would be in practice and whether you can deliver it anyway. So I think the real question facing Labour at the moment is actually whether they're going to back one of these other amendments, which are clearer about essentially trying to delay no deal. I think that's one of the bigger issues now.
Yeah, and Dan, it sounds as though they're going to support this Yvette Cooper amendment, among others, a sort of cross-party effort to allow Article 50 or to mandate the government to delay Article 50 if no other solution has been reached.
Well, this looks absolutely like where the action is, which is Parliament going to rule out a no deal in principle? There's a Jack Dromey's Labour MP, but Caroline Spelman, who's a moderate Conservative in this debate, put down this sort of very simple amendment. You know, Parliament declares it's against a no deal and looks like it's going to attract a lot of support. Now, that amendment would have political force and moral force, but it wouldn't have legislative force. And obviously, Yvette Cooper, following on high-profile Labour backbencher, has been working with Nick Bowles, Conservative ally of Michael Gove, so on and so forth, on this more complicated legislative device, which would delay Article 50 or would allow time to introduce a bill that would delay Article 50 and allow MPs to start thinking about other alternatives, but with a kind of, you know, emphasis here on we're not going to have a no deal situation on March the 29th, because that's implied, if you like, by a delay of Article 50. Now, given that Labour looks highly likely to support these things, there's a serious chance of these getting through the Commons next Tuesday. And that starts to create a beginnings, perhaps, of a deadline of something where actually Theresa May might have to jump. And you know, if no deal is taken off the table, that is a problem for Theresa May's strategy, because that's her chief alternative threat. And I think the question is, what do the Tory Brexiters do at that point?
It's interesting, though, isn't it? Because to some extent, it hinders her because she wants to threaten them with no deal. But to another extent, it helps her, because if you're one of those MPs you were talking about who wants no deal, well, you can't have that. Maybe her deal's better than that.
Yeah, I think it could help her, but only to a certain extent, because ultimately, if no deal is taken off the table and Theresa May doesn't take Jacob Rees-Mogg's advice to just suspend Parliament so it can't be taken off the table.
Yesterday's alarming suggestion, yeah.
Growing force amongst certain Brexiteers. But if that were to happen, then Theresa May could make a clear pitch to these Leave MPs saying my deal really is the only way to guarantee some form of Brexit. But even then, I think there's about 20 Conservative MPs, and Brexiteers will tell you this, who are not going to move.
Come what may.
So she needs 116 extra votes to get a deal through. That means she would still need some Labour votes. And I think as soon as you take no deal off the table, it gets much harder to get, you know, 20, 30 Labour MPs around this, because they would say, well, I'm not in a hurry now. I'd actually like you to move like this. I think it should be a bit more like the Labour position. We hold out, we get a general election. So I don't think it helps her in the long term. And one way in which the government are trying potentially to get back on track is considering a Brexity amendment, that's a technical term, which would basically do something, which would something on the backstop, which would basically... So we had the Morrison Amendment last time around that was not selected by John Bercow, but it was signed by lots of seen as generally loyal Tory backbenchers who were Eurosceptic. People like Sir Graham Brady, who is the chair of the 1922 committee. So, you know, it's very in there with the feeling of the party who signed it. And that was to say that they would support this deal if there was a time limit on the backstop. Now, obviously, Brussels have not agreed to that, but there is a thinking again. Now, Morrison Amendment is now being put up again, and there is a view within some figures in government, some in the cabinet, that if they can get enough Tory MPs and potentially the DUP to support that amendment, it would show Brussels, which is what they wanted to do the last time around, that if they get a concession on the backstop, they can get this deal through Parliament. I think it's still a bit of an ask, because some people don't think that amendment solves everything, but I do think that is increasingly seen as the only way Theresa May can show to Barnier and everyone in Brussels that the answer to getting a deal through isn't the softer Brexit, because right now they look at the defeat of 230 votes, and we've seen it in the comments from Brussels. They think actually Theresa May needs to pivot to a customs union, and that's how you get a deal through. So I think this is last chance saloon.
Right. If she gathers enough names, if she gathers enough support, then she goes to Brussels and says, look, I can show you. I can win this if you just do this one thing.
Yeah, I think there's been frustration on the sort of Brexity wing of the cabinet for some time that all the decisions have been forced on the UK. That's the nature of this negotiation with the EU in the stronger position. They basically want to make Brussels make a choice. You know, do you want no deal or do you want this deal that we've just shown you there's a majority for? It's a sort of attempt to throw the ball back into Brussels court. But as Katie says, it's unclear whether Brussels would accept the choice or whether it would work at all.
One thing I thought was very interesting just on that was how, you know, someone from Number 10 told me, I was asking, would they support this Morrison Amendment that Cage has just been talking about? You know, would that send a useful signal to Brussels? And they said, well, we don't really want to say anything because we have no idea whether it'd be helpful or counterproductive, and we don't want to get dragged in. We don't even know whether to speak or select it. So, I mean, that might be classic Mayism that drives everybody mad, but it is just literally they're so struggling for grip that their best strategy is to try not to have any grip at all.
Well, and it's a weird situation where you gain some MPs by shuffling in one direction and maybe you lose a few off the other side. And, you know, where people's preferences for different options depends on what other option they're comparing it to. So the people's vote supporters, the second referendum supporters, are not going to put something down next week because they think it's too soon. We've learned today, Michael, haven't we?
Yeah, so and that's the debate within the sort of second referendum People's Vote campaign. When do you do something? Do you damage your cause by having a vote too early, not getting enough votes, and killing the whole thing? There are still lots of Labour MPs who voted Remain, are Remainer, you would say, but are still instinctively uncomfortable about a second referendum. That's a real political problem that they have to deal with if you want to get to a stage where a second referendum is a real possibility.
But, Katie, if you're not going to support a referendum when, you know, Theresa May's deal's been rejected by a majority of 230 and we're weeks away from a no deal and there doesn't seem to be any alternative, can you ever see it winning majority support?
Well, I thought what was really interesting about the official Labour amendment, which we touched on, which was the idea that we should vote on options, one of which being the Labour's preferred Brexit deal, one of which being if there was support for a second referendum. People got a bit excited that maybe Labour was shifting, but it's clear that in the Commons right now, there just aren't the numbers for a second referendum. So I think it was a bit of an empty move from the Labour team. I think when you look at whether there's support for a second referendum, clearly they don't have the numbers right now, but some of them don't even think they need that. So if you look at the Dominic Grieve amendment, that is to have indicative votes on various options. Now, it's not that those campaigning for a second referendum think that if you had a contest of five votes in a day on all the options, it would get the most votes. Instead, they think that if you can show there's no majority for any option, Theresa May's deal, Norway, even a customs union or no deal, then the next logical step in their mind is that you'll say, well, there's no consensus for anything, so therefore we go to a vote. So I think there's still some that still have hope that because no one can agree on anything, you end up there.
Provided their option gets voted on last. what an extraordinary situation.
Well, an extraordinary situation where you now have Brexiteers, you know, talking about proroguing Parliament, going back hundreds of years. I mean, you know, talk about getting lost in your own metaphor, really. You know, these are the people who pitched themselves as the sort of roundheads championing Parliament, and now they're sort of wanting to give power to the ultimate establishment, the Queen, to sort of scrap the whole thing. So we are in an utter mess, you would say.
We are. And Dan, next week we get another series of votes, but is that, I feel as if I've written that, you know, the sort of crunch vote coming up a number of times now. Is next week's not the end of it, is it?
I think we're making a little bit of progress. I think that if the Cooper Amendment or even the Dromey-Spellman Amendment can get carried, then that is a signal of something or the other, which is that Parliament is really doesn't want a no deal and is prepared to extend Article 50. And I think if they got carried, that would be very interesting. Similarly, I think if the Morrison Amendment got carried, which is a kind of time limit on the backstop, he doesn't put a date on it this time, he did last time, which I think is probably a bit smarter. If the Morrison Amendment got carried, I think, again, that would be some sort of signal to the EU. So I think that would be an interesting sort of direction of travel. And I think, you know, again, if Morrison gets carried, that shows you that Conservative opinion is a bit stronger in the House. And then Remainer opinion would be a bit stronger if Cooper got carried. So the votes next week are going to be significant, even if they're possibly a little bit at the technical end of the market. And it's not the end of the game, but maybe it's the beginning of the end. I'm hopeful.
Goodness knows what they'd make of it all in that Wetherspoons in Portsmouth. Thank you all. My thanks to all my guests, Katie Balls, Dan Sabba, Michael Savage, John Harris and Jennifer Rankin. Producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Heather Stewart. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.